This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a conference this weekend in Philadelphia aimed at bringing some scientific analysis back into movement politics. A mother from the South Bronx speaks out on the police sweep that imprisoned 120 young men, including her son. And Margaret Kimberly tells why the United States needs to keep its bloody hands off Syria.
But first, President Donald Trump's administration will not look anything like the picture painted by candidate Trump, who railed against the influence of corporations and special interests. A new study by the advocacy group Public Interest shows that 70% of the people on Trump's transition team are affiliated with corporations. Former Goldman Sachs banker Steven Mnuchin has been nominated for Secretary of Treasury, but the Barack Obama and Bill Clinton administrations were also top-heavy with Wall Street bankers. We ask Rich Claypool, Research Director for Public Citizen, why should the Trump administration be any different?
The first thing that makes it different is that the Trump campaign made a huge deal about Secretary Clinton's Goldman Sachs connections. And it also made a huge deal during the Republican primaries about connections between Goldman Sachs and Senator Ted Cruz. He pitched the closing sort of remarks of the campaign about how he was going to take on the rigged system and special interests and so on. So what we have is a 180 pivot that is the height of hypocrisy now. If folks thought he was going to stand up to Wall Street, these sort of financial special interests, that seems to be totally untrue. Mnuchin is the appointment we would expect President-elect Trump to have picked if he intends rather to forge a plutocratic alliance with the industry, not take it on.
And Mnuchin is not alone. He'll have plenty of corporate finance capital company.
That's right. You know, we just released a report on the landing teams that is how the incoming administration is shaping the transition for all the federal agencies. And our analysis shows that 70% of the staff coming in from the administration who are working on this transition or have some corporate connection, either as being former lobbyists, being corporate lawyers who have served corporate clients, being CEOs of various companies, working at corporate-backed think tanks. But it really looks like a corporate takeover of Washington. And some have tried to frame what's happening as a sort of populist uprising. And that's certainly not what it looks like is going on if you believe that personnel is policy and these personnel are likely to shape what the policy will be of the administration in the months to come.
Yeah, this looks like one hell of a bait and switch. What kind of reaction do you expect from Trump's rank and file?
You know, it's hard to say. One would expect folks who expected candidate Trump to make good on his promises to drain the swamp, you won't expect they would be furious. They saw that here we have, you know, corporate insider after corporate insider taking over the administration. I guess perhaps, you know, a major distinction between the Obama administration's more corporate appointees is that, you know, generally they were exceptions to the rule. In particular, they were like, you know, there are lobbyists who are appointed, but there is a pretty strict rule against lobbyists. And there are exceptions here. It seems like the corporate interests are really the rule.
And even if you believe Trump's verbal pronouncements, looking at not just his cabinet, but the Republican Congress, it would seem that the public Trump is a party of one in his own administration.
Yeah, it's hard to see to square what the party, its priorities are with some of the things that the candidate Trump said, but you know, what these cabinet appointments and the landing teams and so on. Yeah, I'm sure there are plenty of congressional Republicans who would be quite comfortable and pleased with this sort of outsized influence of corporations in the administration.
And Mnuchin not only has a long history with Goldman Sachs, but he has a history with George Soros, who is one of the prime villains as far as lots of the folks in the Trump camp, we thought, ideologically, were concerned.
Yeah, it's striking that there's, I think, lots of exceptions seem to be being made for Mnuchin in particular, because I think what the Trump camp seems to be favoring above all else is loyalty to the candidate. And Mnuchin was the finance chairman for the campaign, and that seems to be superseding everything from campaign promises to what is expected from what his colleagues on the right side of the aisle.
If there was a core to the Trump campaign besides build a wall, it was to put restrictions on finance capital's ability to move money and jobs around as they see fit. But Goldman Sachs personifies that ability to do just that.
Absolutely. And you're seeing, there are all these claims that Dodd-Frank is the problem. It's not whether Dodd-Frank, the financial reform bill passed in 2010, will be undermined and undercut and dismantled. It's to what extent and how quickly the signature achievement of that bill, which Public Citizen has been a staunch supporter of, is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has worked to protect countless numbers of Americans from predatory aspects of the financial industry and such things that helped lead to the crisis in 2008. What Mnuchin signals is that the fetters are coming off of the financial industry, any of the sort of insignificant ones that were there, and that we can almost certainly expect a return to the Wild West of anything goes risk taking that led to the 2008 crisis in the first place. And of course, the folks who suffer the most from that are ordinary Americans who are just trying to make ends meet. Here you have somebody like Mnuchin. He comes out making off quite well in that, and that history seems more likely to repeat than not.
One would think that Trump supporters would be up in arms and upset at these turns of events, and certainly the actual left in this country has plenty of reason to critique this. But what about the Democrats? Would you expect some kind of resistance from them, given their incestuous relationship with corporate finance?
One would hope. The Democrats are going to be working hard to defend President Obama's legacy. Dodd-Frank is part of that just as much as the Affordable Care Act. But what they really need to be listening to and responding to is this fury from the voters of excessive corporate influence that one can only infer was part of what led people to put Trump in the White House. And if folks are going to be rapidly disappointed with what the president is actually doing, then to offer real solutions that actually help working families as opposed to the bait and switch sham solutions that were offered on the campaign trail.
That was Rick Claypool of the Public Citizen in Washington.
In Philadelphia, activists will gather for a conference December 9th and 10th aimed at bringing a more rigorous scientific analysis to the struggle for social justice. Nandita Chaturvedi is a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania and an organizer of the Conference on Revolutionary Science for Radical Times.
We have been talking about the need for ideological clarity for a while now, and we've been discussing how our action and our efforts to organize have to be guided by some knowledge and in-depth analysis of the complex reality we live in. And so we need spaces that create such knowledge for the people and for people's movements. And I think there was a consensus among all of us that we cannot rely on the university to do this for us anymore, because it has deep ties to the establishment. And you can see this in the way it emphasizes the individual and it emphasizes identity as a path for the left. And so this conference is a small attempt for us to create a space for discussion so that we can have some ideology and knowledge to guide our action going forward.
Well, certainly with the results of the past election, we see lots of folks, including people who call themselves part of the left, tearing their hair out and literally crying, but we don't see much analysis of what happened and what should happen.
Yeah, I think the importance of discussion about analysis has grown since the election, because you see that there's so much confusion in the left And you see activists that are sort of aligning with the liberal media and aligning with the Clinton machinery in their clamor to oppose Trump. And so in order to see clearly what we are trying to oppose and what is the system that we are dismantling, I think analysis is really needed. So, yeah, I think the conference should be a good place to start this discussion.
Well, certainly everybody who comes to a conference that talks about radical science already is convinced that we need analysis that is on the face of it. But what kind of discussions do you anticipate?
Well, I think in today's time, the emphasis has sort of become on identity and on the individual. And in emphasizing identity and the individual, we sort of forget about the collective and we forget about economic structures. And I think we need to put emphasis back on a structural analysis of the system, not only on individuals and individual oppression, but also to talk about what kind of structure does racial oppression and gendered oppression, how does this play into the larger economic system? And eventually it is the economic system that we want to dismantle. So I think an analysis along those lines is needed. And we also need to talk about why we have been talking about identity so much. And I think the university and the education system creates this framework of thinking. And what could have been a radical ideology that was antagonistic to the system has sort of been taken up by capitalism and made part of it. And so we need to see beyond what is no longer a radical ideology so that we can come up with a new way forward.
Well, could you give me an example of what I think you were just describing, co-optation?
That's right. Well, I think a good example would be the spontaneous uprisings we've seen around police brutality in the last few months. And I think that an analysis of the system and what role the police plays in the economic system and larger framework would really help sustain some of these movements and not let them be swept away sort of by focusing on the black identity or, you know, focusing on call-out culture and self-care and trauma.
Well, yes, you're moderating a panel that deals with identity politics and what's described as attacks upon theory. What do you mean, attacks upon theory?
Well, I think when we were planning this conference, we all agreed that we need to think about the role of identity in a larger economic structure. So we don't want to reduce ourselves to just talking about class, as some left parties do in this country. And I think that's a big mistake to treat, you know, race and gender in shallow ways like representation or language. But there is a need to talk about in a structural way. And what we see with identity politics is that it puts economic oppression on the same plane of importance as race and gender and sexuality and everything. And so there's confusion about who we're trying to point our guns to. And as a result, we often end up blaming each other. And, you know, class becomes a sort of ism as opposed to being something more fundamental than that. I think in the recent election, you can see this in the way that the left has sort of been blaming the white working class for this election. And instead of opposing and trying to dismantle the system, we are opposing working class people. And I think part of the reason is because there's confusion about what kind of structure the society we have is based on.
Well, one of the terms that's become popular over the last couple of years is intersectionality, the way different kinds of oppressions are interrelated.
I think intersectionality, again, emphasizes a sort of culture that makes you into more of a victim than an agent of change. And I think it shows you that, look, there are all these systems of oppression that are acting on you. As a result, you're oppressed. But it doesn't give you a way to change these things. And I think this sort of language that's very popular in universities and among academic circles is not spoken by anyone outside these academic circles. And there's a great need to transfer knowledge to people who can use it to, you know, as tools to explain their conditions and try to change their conditions. And I think when we focus on the intersection of oppressive systems and we convert ourselves into victims rather than someone who can change, who can act and change the system, we're taking emphasis away from action and towards more observation.
And also in this panel, you'll be looking not just at the Black liberation movement, something close at hand, but also lessons that might be learned in Latin America.
Yeah, I think we see two tendencies in the left in the United States right now. One is what we've been talking about, which is, you know, identity politics and the focus on identity. And the second is sort of left parties that are mostly made up of white middle-class people, and they have a very strong class analysis, but they often end up ignoring things like race. And we've noticed that there is a great tendency to dismiss movements in other parts of the world. And I think part of the reason why we're unable to form something that's sustainable in the United States, a movement of resistance that's sustainable, is that we refuse to learn from movements in other parts of the world. And I think Latin America is a great example, and especially important now with the passing of Fidel Castro, because we want to talk about what he managed to achieve, and we want to put emphasis on the fact that even though all of these movements have flaws, they have managed to build sustained movements, which us in the United States, in the, you know, belly of the imperialist monster, have not managed to do right now.
But one of the critiques of left movements in Latin America, a critique that comes from folks of color in Latin America, is the tendency on the left to erase race, despite the deep impact it has on societies there.
Yes, well, we don't want to revere anyone uncritically, but we also don't want to stop learning from these movements and from the theories they are based on. But I agree that there is a great need for constructing an ideology that takes into account all these complexities in our society, along with class, in a structural manner, so that we can convert that into action and we can build movements.
And this conference is taking place at the Church of the Advocate, not on the campus of Temple University or some other academic institution. Is that significant?
Yes, definitely. I think that was a conscious decision by all of us, because we want to emphasize the fact that we need spaces for knowledge creation, but these spaces must not be tied to the capitalist establishment. And I think the universities have failed us in this role of knowledge creation. And you can see the role of universities in the current election also. The University of Pennsylvania took out a rally 2 weeks ago, which was against Trump. And so you can see that they sort of align with, you know, the neoliberal machinery. And we want to break away from that. We want to break away from the academic tradition, which is tied to the system we are trying to dismantle.
Much of the politics of Black America, in fact, takes place within the Democratic Party, which has permeated virtually all of the institutions of that community.
Yes, definitely. And I think this election has shown us that there is a refusal of the Democratic Party, and this gives us a space to operate in. And I think when we were organizing the conference, we wanted to put emphasis on the Black community and talk about the Black misleadership class, which has been trying to get Black voters, Black working class people, to vote for the Democratic Party. And I think in Philadelphia, the largest obstacle to a large-scale movement of the Black community is this Black misleadership class.
We also see a great influence of that party in the churches, but the Church of the Advocate seems to be ground in which radicals can at least have a discussion.
Yes, definitely. The Church of the Advocate has historically been very important. It's a community space in North Philadelphia, and Pastor Renee, who's the pastor at the church, will be speaking at the conference. And she is very involved in the struggle for Black liberation in North Philadelphia. And I think one of the spaces that gave rise to this conference is the Free School, which takes place every Saturday at the Church of the Advocate. And it's a space for political discussion and a space for knowledge creation, like the one we're trying to build on a larger scale, which operates outside of the university and more with people who are not academics, who have jobs, who need this analysis.
And this conference on radical politics is not just for Philadelphia only.
Definitely. I think there is a need for ideological clarity everywhere in the United States among the left. And there are people who have approached us who are coming from North Carolina, from Georgia, and we're very excited to have everyone come and to have an open, honest discussion.
That was Nandita Chaturvedi speaking from Philadelphia.
Back in April of this year, an army of police descended on a neighborhood in the Bronx in New York City and arrested 120 young men on conspiracy to commit a wide range of crimes. It was the largest police sweep in New York City's history, even bigger than a similar roundup 2 years ago that dragged 103 young people in Harlem to prison. Both sweeps were centered on public housing projects. Paula is the mother of a teenager swept up in this year's police raid in the Bronx. She chose not to use her last name in fear of police retaliation against her son.
They came to my house in the pre-dawn of April 27th of this year, helicopters with all the elements of war, helicopters, bombs around the house. They stormed the door, came into my living room, more than a dozen FBI agents and two New York City Police officers. And that's when I knew something was amiss.
You didn't know that there were so many other families who were in a similar situation as you.
I had no idea. I thought it was just me. I had no idea until everything was over and I learned on the news, like everyone else, of the massive showdown in our neighborhood.
In terms of the news, the newspaper that played up this sweep, the biggest was the Daily News, and it seemed to not only agree with the way this operation went down, but to celebrate it.
Yes, many of the parents, as well as myself, were very angered by the Daily News because they demonize our youth, and they're not the mafia as they're charged under the RICO. None of these youth had stockpiles of weapons, or arsenals, firearms, or narcotics like that in that massive, what you'd expect from a mafia, like Al Capone or, you know, whatever. And they're not influencing other organizations as the RICO law, you know, suggests.
It seemed that all some of the youths had in common was a knowledge of each other.
Yes, because they grew up in the same neighborhood. They go to the same school. They go to the park after school because there are no other resources within the neighborhood. Because this is generally a poor neighborhood. We don't have the resources like the other, like the suburbs and other areas. So many of the kids after school, they hang out in the park. So they know one another from going to school and you know, being in the park. And that's how they've grown up in the community. You know, there's no community without an affiliation. We are all affiliated.
And yet the police saw those affiliations, that those folks' knowledge of each other, of their own neighbors, as evidence of a conspiracy.
Yes, and that's what's so damaging about the whole thing. You know, this whole conspiracy. I mean, these are kids, you know, they're normal kids like any other kids that do kid stuff together. You know, they're not planning a big crime or anything like that. They're just kids doing what kids do.
How's your own son standing up under this?
Well, my son has, you know, he's not doing very well under this circumstance. Since September 16th, my son has been in solitary confinement to this day. And he has suffered severe mental illness from being in confinement. So much so that he suffers from paranoia, a lot of mental disturbances, anxiety, depression. And he wasn't even able to go to court on the court date, October 19th, as other defendants, because the behaviors he was eliciting from being in confinement.
We're told that every one of the 120 defendants is barred from sharing a lawyer that's being utilized by another one of the defendants. Is that true?
Yes, because of a conflict of interest, they do not allow defendants to have the same lawyer. They have to have their own independent different lawyers due to the conflict of interest. That's something that people have pursued, but we were told that because of the conflict of interest, it would not be that would not be wise, yes.
Which means that each family has to come up with the money for a separate lawyer, unless, of course, you're depending upon a public defender. And families cannot coordinate to mount a common defense against this conspiracy of conspiracies.
Yes, most of the lawyers are court-appointed lawyers. There are only a small percentage, maybe 1% of parents who have their own private lawyers. So, because there's no, it's just not a thing. There's no money. And, you know, they think that these kids would be, have all this money because they're charged under the RICO Act for, you know, narcotics and firearms. You expect them to have an abundance of money. They could hire their own private lawyers, but that's not the way it is. So they're stuck with the court-appointed lawyers for the most part, more than 80%, 90% of the defendants.
So here we have a community that is not well off financially from the very beginning, and now it's burdened with all of these defense bills and the expense of maintaining them within the prison itself.
Oh, yes. The parents, we have to send them money for the commissary, the emails, the phone calls, all of that. It's like the prison reminds me so much of the plantations. You know, the whole plantation system is a money-making thing, and they're using our youth to get all this money. You know, it's good, and some of these prisons are like private prisons. You know, they make a lot of money. It generates a lot of cash, you know, from the government and from the parents sending money to their children.
What was the effect on the other young people and family members in the neighborhood after the sweep? You can't just take 120 people away and not have an effect on those who remain.
Well, the whole place is barren. It's like, you know, all the youth has totally disappeared. It's like there's like a form of castration. It's like they're, you know, it's all young youths, males, and it's left the community broken. You know, families are broken. Their sons, their fathers, some of them are fathers. You know, they belong to someone. And so there's an emptiness. So it's really affected the community as a whole.
We know that some activist organizations have stepped forward to be of whatever use they can be. But what about local elected officials? Have you gotten any relief or at least encouragement from them?
No, we have not gotten any support from local officials. We have reached out to them. We reached out to Andy King. We reached out to even the Bronx DA. And they're more in support of the raid. They're not in support of the fact that our youths are becoming extinct. You know, they're becoming endangered species. And the raids is one of that causing all this to happen. And we do have a good support group, Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, IWOC, that's been there with us from the very start, and that's been our greatest strength and support throughout. And local officials, they're more in league with the raids. They support the raids, you know, without realizing what it's doing to the community, what it's doing to our families, and this whole it's gentrification thing that's going on is like causing them to get rid of our youth, to make space for incoming demographics.
Yes. Do you see a relationship, and apparently you do, a relationship between these intense police pressures on communities and gentrification?
Oh, certain there is. That's certainly a factor. Certainly a factor. And a lot of people don't really see it, but it's certainly a factor, because even in the public housing, they're trying to privatize the public housing. And the families from the public houses are more impacted than those from the private houses, because they're being forced out, they're being displaced, especially after they had signed a permanent exclusion to make sure their sons don't come back to their apartment once, you know, they have been committed a crime or something.
And they're not only demonizing those young men that have been arrested, but the entire public housing community as being some kind of blot that must be taken out.
Oh yes, they're trying to, yeah, exactly. That's the aim. That's what I think the aim of the whole thing is. And they want to displace all these people. And I know a lot of mothers, families who have been impacted by this and who are currently going to court through eviction process. So So it's really horrendous. They have their sons in jail, and they, at the same time, they're going through an eviction process.
And all of this is happening under Mayor de Blasio, who came into mm-hmm. office, well, talking like some kind of liberal.
Yeah, and he has a black son. Yeah, he has a black family, and you think that he'd be more empathetic to what's going on in our community. But it's not that way. You know, he really doesn't support. I don't know what to say about de Blasio, because that's why when we have to vote, we have to make sure we elect the right person that will represent us.
To what extent are the family members of those who've been swept up, to what extent have they organized as a group?
Well, that's not our problem. We have a hard time finding, a lot of parents are working parents, as we know, and there are only a few parents, including myself, who have really been organizing and been supportive to one another. And but the majority of parents, it's kind of, you know, it's difficult getting them involved because they're working, or, you know, they can't make it. It's terrible that we can't get everyone to come together to join us in the struggle to try and save our sons, or to do whatever we can do. I expected to find more support from the parents.
And on a day-to-day level, folks need certain things from the commissary when they're in prison. How can our listeners be of service there?
Well, we have bronx120.org. They can reach out to bronx120.org or even Facebook, Free the Bronx 120. And they also can contact us through IWOC, IWOC, IWOC.NYC at riseup.net. So again, it's bronx120.org. Bronx120.org, they can donate, because it's something we need to help the defendants or their commissary, as you said, and even sometimes for legal fees, if necessary. I'd like to reach out to all the families impacted by the raid. We just had another raid last week, Monday, at 170th and Morris Avenue. We want all those families impacted by the raid to contact us. Please reach out to us. We need you. We need support in numbers. And we're depending on you to contact us and join our organization in the struggle for our kids.
Is it your impression that raids like this, although not quite as big, are happening around the city?
Oh, yes, it's continuing to happen. I think the mayor promised that there will be, and the NYPD, they promised that there will be 20 more raids. So it's something that's going to continue, and especially since we're entering the Trump era, we're going to have raids for immigration. All different kinds of raids are going to be happening simultaneously. So we need to really be aware of what's happening in our community and to stand together, you know, and fight against these raids, which is destroying our community and destroying our neighborhoods and destroying families.
That was Paula, mother of a police raid victim in the Bronx, New York.
The Syrian government, with the help of Russia and other allies, seems on the verge of winning back control of Aleppo, its biggest city, much to the consternation of the United States, which has for years armed and financed Islamic jihadist fighters. Black Agenda Report editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly is an activist with the United National Anti-War Coalition and part of the Hands Off Syria Coalition. She spoke at a coalition gathering in New York City last week.
When I talk about Syria, I always start with a very simple premise, and that is that the United States has no right to intervene in the affairs of other countries. No right to choose governments, to subvert elections, or any other democratic process. And this stance is especially important to remember right now, this crucial moment in the history of Syria. Beginning in 2011, fresh from the sadly successful, I say successful in quotes, destruction of Libya, the Obama administration decided to do the same in Syria. And the claim is, as others have said, the claim is always the same. There's a tyrant who oppresses his own people and who must be taken out of power. And it doesn't matter if the same people suffer in the process of these allegedly humanitarian ventures. The claim is always a lie, a ruse to make real the project for a new American century. And that Orwellian term came from the Bush era, but the Democratic president was happy to continue what Republicans started, because they're all neocons, they're all proud members of the War Party. The humanitarian crisis, which grieves everyone, is entirely the fault of the United States, NATO, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Israel. And absent their effort to get rid of Assad, there would be no sieges, no starvation, no 9 million refugees, or 500,000 deaths. Here in America, we have to be careful, those of us who are call ourselves anti-war. We're always at a disadvantage when our government decides to attack another country. We have to play catch-up. And whatever the manner of the aggression, whether it's a military assault or sanctions, we suddenly feel the need to learn about Libya or Syria or Somalia and decide if the government in question is worthy of being defended. But I think this tactic is very wrong-headed for a couple of reasons. One, because these assessments can only lead to giving justification for aggression that is always carried out for an evil purpose. America never has clean hands in these situations. Secondly, I think it's important to point out the United States never has a humanitarian purpose in mind, in Syria or any place else, and any more so than it does here at home. So I think it's important to point out the, you know, when people make the case Assad must go, they always talk about human rights abuses, as if the United States is the country to get rid of human rights abuses. But I think we've got to point out what happens here, the domestic human rights abuses that are appalling. The fact that this country is the biggest prison nation in the world, with 2 million people incarcerated, more than any other country in the world, a greater number of people and percentage of the population. The fact that these people are imprisoned mostly because of racism, half of these people are black, a quarter of prisoners on the planet are black Americans. And in these prisons all over the country, incarcerated people are subjected to horrible things, to sexual assault, to lack of medical care, to solitary confinement. Even women giving birth are shackled. And those who may escape these various abuses are forced to supply free labor for corporate interests. And all of these things are categorized as torture by every internationally accepted definition. And yes, this does have something to do with Syria. We have to fight the wars abroad, and we have to fight the wars at home, and we have to tie these issues together, even though they may seem to be distinct. And it's important to point out these hypocrisies because Americans of all political stripes are susceptible to this propaganda that America is a good nation with benevolent motives, and that's a common belief. But when that belief is tied to news reports, which always put the target nation, in this case Syria, in a negative light, we end up with people who are humanitarians otherwise signing on to support war crimes committed by our government. Earlier this year, after 5 years of the American-led attack, we were suddenly told that Syrians were going hungry because of sieges that were all blamed entirely on the Assad government. And it was funny, the sources of these stories. For example, MSNBC, or as I call it, Fox News for Democrats, was suddenly front and center expressing outrage, which was ironic considering that they led the charge in supporting this war. And I was curious, what do they think happens in a war? Of course people go hungry, that's always true. And it's a reason to stop and think before allowing oneself to promote something horrible because the person in your political party is the one doing the dirty deed. So I don't think it can be said often enough that the suffering of Syrians is the fault of the United States government. And the cruelty that is committed against people here, the fact that every day 3 Americans are killed by the police, I don't think that happens anywhere else on the planet. And if you're going to talk about a right, a responsibility to protect, somebody could make the case for a responsibility to protect us. And I don't know if I would feel very good if I ended up as a refugee because someone else suddenly claimed that they were going to stop the evil American government. I think it's also important to point out that this carnage could have stopped earlier. There have been diplomatic efforts. Russia said publicly, diplomats such as Marty Arasari have gone on record to say that several years ago they put out feelers to talk to the United States, but the Obama administration wanted nothing less than total victory for its friends in ISIS and al-Nusra, which has changed its name. I can't remember the new name. But in any case, so now we have, here we are, we're having this discussion now because there's been an election. There's going to be a new president in 2 months, and Donald Trump is going to be the president. And we knew what would happen with Hillary Clinton. She was, if nothing else, consistent. She said she would make the case for a no-fly zone, which was nonsense because Russia pretty much declared its own no-fly zone. And this was something that risked war with another nuclear nation. But instead we have Donald Trump, who says many different things. He's against regime change, but let's grab the oil. So we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen with U.S. foreign policy. But we do know the world hasn't stopped turning, and nobody has stopped in Syria doing what they were doing before because there's going to be a new president. The Syrian government is determined to retake Aleppo, and obviously they want to do it before January 20th. So the outcome is not entirely dependent upon what the United States and its allies may or may not do. And in any case, there's a great, and rightly so, skepticism about any sort of change. But I do think it's important to recognize that the United States is not the only player. And our role, the role of our government, that is to say, may be less important than we think. So here we are with a change, but the Democratic Party has not left the field of battle entirely. And we see their attempts. I thought it was interesting that Obama ran off to talk to Angela Merkel the first thing after the election, trying to do no God knows what. But in any case, so now we have a new president. But the Democrats have not backed down. Last week there was an anonymous website that was created several months ago called Is It Propaganda or Not? Propernot.com released a list of news sources it called Russian agents, useful idiots, Putin's puppets, whatever. And we at Black Agenda Report were among those listed. We're very happy about that because it's proof that we tell the truth and we're not beholden to what the government wants us to say. But this is a Democratic Party effort by the Washington Post ran with this story, and they're working with the Democrats and Jeff Bezos, their owner, to continue as much of the Obama doctrine as they possibly can. And it's funny because during this campaign season, the word fascism was bandied about very frequently, and I think often without cause, and directed at Trump. But this is fascism in action, but it came from the other wing of the war party duopoly. So the war party isn't going to disappear, and regardless of what Trump wants, whatever that is, and who knows, sometimes I think he doesn't know from one minute to the next. But the Republicans have made it quite clear they do not want a change in the agenda for hegemony. And so we don't know. But I think it's important to point out that the Syrian government is about its business, and that's going to be the case regardless of what the new president does. And it's funny that we hear all these charges of war crimes directed at Syria, directed at their ally Russia. But there's something similar going on in Iraq, which is a neighboring nation. And that is also the fault of the United States. ISIS is only active in places where the U.S. has intervened. I'm sure you've noticed that. Iraq, Libya, Syria. And there's a terrible fight going on there, terrible suffering going on there. But it's also caused by the United States. But this charge of war crimes doesn't come up when it's this country. So I think in closing, I just want to say that the suffering of the Syrian people is not something that anybody takes lightly. And I assume that anybody here wants to see their pain ended. But I said earlier, I don't think it's my place or anybody's place to determine whether Assad's history or any leader that's targeted by the United States, whether their history should be the determining factor in opposing American-instigated wars. Syrians have a right to fight back, lest their nation end up like a total ruin like Iraq or Libya. And regardless of what is or isn't true about Assad, I oppose his country's actions, and I support his effort to send these terrorists out. And we should want people everywhere to exercise their right to self-determination. And Syrians cannot do that now. And even if you wanted to make the case for a change in government, that can't happen now in the middle of this catastrophe. The most basic human right is the right to live. And Syrians have been deprived of that right because of the United States. And progressives used to value international dialogue, but now we prefer, or too many people prefer, to just follow the Democratic Party, which now turns out can't even win elections against people they thought they could beat. So I think it's important for us to reclaim that history that we had of standing up for the rights of self-determination for people all over the world.
Thank you very much.
Bar editor and senior columnist Margaret Kimberly.
In Washington last week, the anti-war group Cold Pink held a two-day People's Tribunal on the Iraq War as they stepped toward making the United States accountable for its aggression against that country. The tribunal was covered live for 2 days by the Real News Network. One of those who testified was Michael Sampson, a Florida native and co-founder of the Dream Defenders, and now a labor organizer in the Washington area.
Mamia Abu-Jabal gave a speech from prison, The War Versus All. It went, "The war against us all, this is the war. The war in Iraq isn't the end, it's the beginning of wars to come. All around the world, at the whim of the neocons in the White House, this is the Bush doctrine come to life. War, war, and more war. War brought to you by big corporate masters who run the show. This isn't just a war on Iraqis or Afghanis or Arabs or even Muslims. It's ultimately a war on us all. That's because the billions and billions that are being spent on this war, the cost of tanks, rocketry, bullets, and yes, even salaries, for the 125,000 plus troops is money that will never be spent on education, on healthcare, on the reconstruction of public housing, or to train and place millions of people who've been displaced from jobs in the past 3 years alone. The war in Iraq is in reality a war against the nation's workers and the poor, who are getting less and less while the big defense industries are literally making a killing." So I wanted to start hearing that was one of my first growing up in terms of seeing the Iraqi war and the horrible negative effect it's had on the Iraqi people and as well as people here. That was kind of one of my first impressions of connecting the two. Of course, we've seen numbers of Iraqi lives lost, over 150,000 to even a million, some projections. And that's horrible in itself. Part of it is sort of using an analysis of us to connect our struggles together. So the struggle of those fighting against oppression in Iraq, how is that connected to me as an African-American person? How is that connected to the struggle of African-Americans fighting oppression here? And quite clearly to me, it is. The same tanks, the same police equipment, the same military equipment that the war profiteers are spending billions of dollars on, have gotten rich contracts on, are the same tanks, the same rockets, the same tear gas canisters that are being thrown on the streets of Ferguson and Baltimore, or Milwaukee, or Charlotte, or how many other cities will come. It's all connected to each other. I had the opportunity to spend a week in Ferguson following the murder of Mike Brown, and I saw clearly a people who are upset with the existing order, who are upset with how things were going, and they were in the streets, and they were demanding something better. And then I saw a police state make up lies, say folks were being threatened, and then use tear gas canisters on these peaceful protesters. I myself was tear gassed, and I can remember going to a gas station afterwards and talking to an attendant there about, you know, like, I just got tear gassed. It sucks. that person who worked there was actually like, get an onion and something, something, something. And I was like, how do you know this? And he was like, well, I'm from the West Bank. I'm from, you know, like I have this experience, like, and the tear gas they use here is nowhere near the tear gas they use there. So all of these conflicts, the war overseas, the war in Iraq, the wars that occur everywhere are all connected to the war at home that we have here. A war on working class people, a war on black and brown people in this country. The same profiteers, G4S Home Security, these are the same profiteers who are getting contracts here in the United States to watch public housing where mostly African Americans live. In D.C. alone, we had recently had a case of a private home security firm killing an unarmed African American man on the street with no accountability. But why is police becoming privatized in that sense? Why is it that we have a private security forces overseas, but we also have these same private security forces in the United States patrolling black neighborhoods? It has to be a connection. And the same people who profit, the same people who are making this policy, are the same people who are oppressing us. And it's up to us to kind of see that and understand that. A lot of the work I've done in the past has been sort of educating folks who look like me, and also students, and also folks I come into interaction with every day about how this all connects to each other. We can't see a war overseas and not see a war at home as well. The police military equipment that was said earlier is being purchased in record numbers. That's the same police military equipment that we see being bought by police departments. And it's the same police military equipment that activists in the United States, part of the movement for Black Lives Matter, part of a lot of different movements, the student movements, are fighting to get off their campuses, the fighting to get out of their cities, out of their police departments. So these movements must connect. There's no rhyme or reason why we have an anti-war movement here that isn't connected to a movement for black freedom here or a movement for brown freedom here. All these movements must connect, because at the end of the day, the people who profit the most are the war profiteers, are the imperialists. These are the people who colonize Iraq and the same people who colonize African Americans here. These are the same 1% of folks who make billions of dollars off our sweat and labor as we work, but don't want to give us the right to unionize. These are the same people who, at the end of the day, see as nothing but a number to crunch and as a figure to manipulate and control. It was Amiri Baraka, a famous poet, activist, who wrote, "No nation can be free if it oppresses another." And that's something that we should definitely take into account. How can we claim to be the land of the free, home of the brave, when we're oppressing nations here, domestically, as well as in Iraq or other nations? We're participating in the oppressions of nations elsewhere. That's not a policy that promotes freedom. That's a policy that promotes hatred towards us. That's a policy that promotes death. And we've seen so many deaths here and abroad. And we have to see that all connecting to each other. So I kind of want to end on that. I think it's important moving forward. I remember being in Baltimore and seeing the rebellion sort of start there. Like, I was at the mall. I saw it on Twitter. I went to the mall, the Mandawin Mall, when I heard kids were throwing rocks at police officers. And then I remember going up there and seeing, you know, kids, you know, throwing rocks at police officers. But this was like hundreds of police officers in police military gear and militarized riot gear. And how in the world can, in this country, we have a situation in which our children are being criminalized and having to see this before they're even of age to buy a pack of cigarettes? So many kids are so many of our children, black children, brown children, are criminalized in this country. And these are the same tactics that are used elsewhere in Iraq. All these struggles must connect in a very succinct way, and we must see that to free a nation elsewhere, we have to free nations here as well. And we have to make sure that that solidarity is shown between the anti-war movement and between the movement for black freedom in this country.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.